Development Committee meets the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m. and is looking for new members. Work on the committee includes evaluating and implementing fundraising and outreach strategies, developing and strengthening partnerships and collaborations, and advocating for KBOO in the community. If you are interested in joining the committee, contact Development Director Allison Kolb at allison@kboo.org to learn more. Meetings are held at KBOO, located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Please call the station at 503-231-8032 prior to the meeting to confirm that it is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Pete Seeger Tribute and 100th Birthday Celebration on Friday, May 3rd from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. The 6th annual Pete Seeger Tribute is a family-friendly sing-along event that features Lauren Sheehan, Peter Hayes, Ben Davis, Bill Merlin, and many more. Again, that's the Portland Pete Seeger Tribute and 100th Birthday Celebration on Friday, May 3rd from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by member listeners and support from the Portland State University Hatfield School of Government. They're offering master's degrees in public administration for those who want to create an efficient and inclusive cities, government agencies, and nonprofits. For more information, you can go online at pdx.edu/Hartfield School. Also by Rose City Chocolate Festival, May 4th and 5th at Doubletree Hotel by Hilton in the Lloyd District, featuring handcrafted work from local and national chocolate makers, including milk chocolate, dark chocolate, specialty bars, truffles, toffee, and more. Open to the public, family-friendly. Tickets and more information on available online at rosecitychocolate.com. And if you didn't miss the announcement earlier, More Talk Radio is off today. This is First Voices Radio coming up at 8, and stay tuned to KBOO.
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Makakilil, Hakantan Katakum, Achaki, Akeheon, on a hoki chill a money picked. Makakil, Hokila, Moshikil, Leon Hitchin, Leon Yuta.
Tatani ma.
Away, 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 away Ihane washtelo na ambetu washtelo. Oyate troka here with chakie imachi apelo naha yuha chante washte na page use up yellow. Le unki biki he washtelo oyate hona umpi ohola oshkati wichoni. Greetings and good day and welcome, my relatives. I shake your hands with good feelings in my heart, and the whole world is a beautiful day. It's good for all of us to be here and let the people hear your voice respectfully and celebrate life. And now, in addition to relativity, this is First Voices Radio, and I send you greetings and strength from the east gate of Turtle Island, where the sun and the water touch the earth at once, and our website is firstvoicesindigenousradio.org. And I want to thank you for your generosity, as always, and for being here. You know who you are. Without you, we cannot continue, and I'm your host, Hyokusin Kostors. This is an all-Native-hosted and all-Native-produced First Voices Radio now, and it's 26th year of broadcasting, and our First Voices Radio producer is Liz Hill. Welcome to the 1 in 74 FM stations that carry First Voices Radio. Thanks to those of you who monitor this program, a heartfelt thank you. Now let's count some coup. Greg Deal has been a regular guest on First Voices Radio. Over the years, we've talked about a lot of issues ranging from cultural appropriation, decolonization, the continuing use of Native mascots and stereotypes, and even the annual spectacle, Burning Man. And Greg brings all of this together and more in a talk that he delivered at Colorado College in Colorado Springs, Colorado, on March 26, 2018. Indigenous Identity and Existence, Fighting Erasure and Racism, is the name of his presentation. It's just under 40 minutes in length, and I invite you to listen carefully because Greg includes a lot of history and his own knowledge and insight and touches on many of the topics that we've discussed here on First Voices Radio. But before I get to the audio, Greg Deal is a husband and father, an artist, and a member of the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe. And Greg is an artist activist. His art includes paintings and mural work, performance art, filmmaking, and a spoken word. Much of Greg's work deals with indigenous identity and pop culture. He touches on issues of race relations, historical consideration, and stereotype. Greg's art has been exhibited nationally. He also has lectured at many prominent educational institutions and museums, including the Denver Art Museum, Dartmouth College, Columbia University, and the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. And now, Greg Deal.
I am privileged to stand before you guys. There's so much to unpack, and there's a lot to unpack for the Black community, as well as other people of color, as well as you fair-skinned friends that are deriving from Europe. And and it is my hope to be able to say some words that enlightened and that help and that continue the conversation here. Before I start, and I do this with every speaking engagement, I always introduce my family because they are the center of everything that I do. I've been married for 19 years. So I was about 50 pounds lighter, and I've been married to the same woman this entire time. And she doesn't let me take pictures of her. This is the most current picture I have of her. And we have 5 children. Yeah, why don't you come babysit at my house sometime? And there's an interesting set of things that happen with this, particularly with my work and in the way that I present myself, in the way that I think critically about being indigenous in the modern age, and that is that I have children that are fair-skinned and that are what they would call white-passing. And this plays a significant role in the conversation that happens in identity. That our identity is wrapped up in stereotype and what people expect us to look like and not what we actually inform that you should be looking at. And I'll be honest, I'm using them because they humanize me a little bit. We're gonna be talking about some things that are gonna be difficult to talk about and difficult to even reconcile, but that's what this is all about. It's about reconciliation. And as we come to know more about ourselves and know more about our history and know about our origins, there is a process of reconciliation that must take place. I find that to be an easier conversation. I want to give you a little bit of reference. This is my work. I'm just going to go through it a little bit. But a big part of my work is thinking critically about the spaces that I occupy. thinking critically about what it means to be an indigenous person in the modern age, what sorts of things we have to do and what sorts of things we try to avoid, what sorts of things we're trying to access in finding a sense of equality and a sense of consideration, equal consideration in the United States. So I've done murals and I've done paintings. This is a piece in Baltimore that happened right after Freddie Gray, and the city was a boiling pot, if I could say that. And everybody was talking about, well, you know, this is traditionally a black neighborhood, and this is traditionally a Latino neighborhood, and this is traditionally a white neighborhood. I put these murals all over the city to be like, yeah, well, you know, before it was Indian land. But I have this image, and it's called The Duality of Indigeneity. And it's very much about the way that we exist in America, that we have a duality to our existence, that we are both traditional and modern, that we listen to the traditional musics, powwow music, ceremony, but we're also listening to Kendrick Lamar. And that these things exist as part of our existence. So that when you look at this and you see the same face, and one looks Indian and the other one looks like a kid, and the question that is begged is, which one is more Indian? And the answer is that they're both Indian. They're both Native. Within my work, there's an effort of activism as well. I lived in Washington, D.C. for 17 years. I moved here about 2.5 years ago. And the conversation about the Washington football team, the representation, and even that word, what that word means, which we'll get to in just a minute. And I have performance art. Performance art is mostly what I'm known for. I did do this on Columbus Day, by the way, just keeping it real. This is The Last American Indian on Earth. We're showing this film tomorrow, but it is about dressing like the stereotype, going into public, and documenting the way that people reacted and interacted with me. There's this thing that happens, and has happened throughout my entire life, where people are like, you know, you're being too sensitive. You just gotta let it go, you gotta get over it. The film and the documentation of this proves that I'm not sensitive, that there is a significant problem in consideration of indigenous people in our place in America. But within this effort of creating art is also about creating situations and imagery and using language that surrounds indigenous people virtually all the time. But it goes by as what we call microaggressions, which I think is a really interesting term, because microaggression is more of a statement about how you perceive what is being done to me and not what is actually being done to me. But performance art is very much about putting myself on the line. We're the only group of people in the country that have to, if not the world, that have to be identified as being indigenous by a set of standards that is created by the federal government called Blood Quantum. And that these are a list of fractions that explain who we are and where we come from, and that is documented and is maintained and validates our Indianness. It is a Western standard of deciding who is and who is not Indian. And in this performance piece, which is called Indian Pedigree, I had my entire blood quantum tattooed on my forearm while I did a spoken word piece, with the understanding that the only things regulated in this manner in the United States are horses and dogs and Indians. And I have it on my forearm. And I wanted to show this as well. This is a piece I did in 2016 with a Muslim performance artist at the Smithsonian. And it is very much about intersectionality. It is about, having done this in 2016, it was very relevant given what the campaign trail was looking like and the conversation and the vernacular that existed during that time. All of what I do is very much about language. And it's about consideration of language and thinking critically about that language and how all of these things work and exist together. Now, you may hear me use the term white people during this process. if I am saying something that does not apply to you, I am not talking to you. And I think that's important to note. But I cannot deny that the majority of the population of this country has been white people. And the majority of the decisions that have been made that have created the country that we are in have been white people. And while there is a transition in who is the majority of this country and who isn't, this is still where we are, and this is still part of the conversation. That might be hard, and that's okay, because I think reconciliation is not supposed to be an easy thing. So let's talk about this word real quick, Indian. You know, language is such an incredible thing, and you can see how incredible it is as it's being twisted now with this new administration and with his cohorts, and the way that they sort of talk about things and use language in a way that is almost twisted and perverse. But at its basic level, we all know who Christopher Columbus is, right? And we all know, and we've all been taught, that Christopher Columbus came to this country and discovered. And he actually was lost. We all know that too, that he came here and he thought he was in India. And as a result of thinking he was in India, he called the indigenous people of the north and south and even the Bahama area where he landed, because he didn't actually come to America. And he called us Indians. And that 500 years later, we know all of this, but we still use this word to describe the indigenous people on this land. And that is the power of words. The word redskin is a dictionary-defined racial slur. It's also the name of a national football team, one of the most popular in the world. The term redskin actually comes from Manifest Destiny. It's been used in a few other ways, but during Manifest Destiny, as they're moving west for expansion, for progress, I've got a lot of air quotes, for progress, Native people are in the way. And so there were bounties that were placed upon the heads of Native people. And bounty hunters went out and they hunted down Native people and they killed them. And they get paid, according to men and women and children and elders. And the way that they get paid by those things is that they have to collect a trophy. And a trophy comes in the way of scalps and hands and severed heads and the literal skins off the backs of people, genitalia, any number of ways that you can bring those bloody red skins to a place to get your payoff. That before Manifest Destiny had completely taken hold and before there was an economy, our skins were the economy. This is the problem with this word and as it's being used and the way that it's being used in popular culture. And those things are all about dismissing our existence. Do you guys know who this is? Can one person say his name? George Washington, okay. They call him our forefather. And he has an important role. When it comes to history, I believe that there is a really important way to look at these things. And that important way to look at it is to consider that there are multiple sides to everything. So the first president of this great nation was also significantly anti-Indian. His troops, they would go into these communities and they would skin bodies of the Iroquois from the hips down to make boot tops or leggings. And think about that for a second. The first president of the United States was party to skinning Indian people. You know, within a 5-year period, 28 out of the 30 towns that were occupied by the Seneca Nation in the Northeast had been destroyed. And he was responsible for that. We even look at somebody like Abraham Lincoln, the great emancipator. But what we don't know is that a week before the Emancipation Proclamation was supposed to be implemented, the day after Christmas, he signed off on the largest mass hanging in American history. 38 indigenous people. And they were hung because they were stuck on a reservation, a plot of land under armed guard. We call it a reservation. It was more like a prisoner of war camp. but they were starving. Nobody was giving them food. So all of the men got up and they went out on raiding parties to find food so they could feed their families. And because they did that, people died. And so as a result, they wanted to make an example of these Indians, these savages that were simply hungry and trying to feed their families. Originally, it was almost 400 people. They whittled it down to 38 into the largest mass hanging in American history. I don't tell this to be decisive about Abraham Lincoln. I tell you this because there are multiple sides to the story, and we have to consider all of these sides so that we can reconcile not just ourselves, but the people that we coexist with here. Sand Creek Massacre happened in Colorado here. It was in November 26, 1864. 675 men were part of the U.S. Volunteer Cavalry under the command of U.S. Army Colonel John Chivington, who, by the way, hated Indians very much. They went and they killed, it's estimated between 70 and 163. Nobody bothers to count these things. About two-thirds of them were women and children. I have some quotes from firsthand experience of what happened during this. If you don't know about Sand Creek, you should look it up. It's only about 2 hours from here. One of the quotes says, "I saw bodies of those lying there cut to pieces, worse mutilated than I ever saw before. The women cut all the pieces with knives, scalped, their brains knocked out, children 2 or 3 months old, all lying there from suckling infant to warriors. By whom were they mutilated? By the United States troops." That's by John Smith, congressional testimony in 1865. A reporter said, "I saw one squaw lying on the bank whose leg had been broken. A soldier had come up to her and had drawn a saber. She raised her arm to protect herself, and he struck, breaking her arm. She rolled over and raised her other arm, and he struck, breaking that, and then he left her without killing her. I also saw a squaw cut open with her unborn child laying by her side." Another statement says, fingers and ears were cut off. The bodies of fur jewelry that they carried. The body of White Antelope lying solidarily in the creek bed was a prime target, and besides scalping him, the soldiers cut off his nose and his ears and his testicles, the last part for a tobacco pouch. This is the history that our country is built upon. We are built upon significant concepts of supremacy, white supremacy, and it has been believed that anybody who was not that was simply less than human. I'm gonna pick this up a little bit because I wanna make sure that we finish during an appropriate amount of time. I do wanna mention boarding schools. Boarding schools were put together in 1879 is when they first started. This is the Carlisle Indian School. I wanna give you some numbers. Boarding schools are essentially forced assimilation schools. Children were forcibly or sometimes under significant effort taken from families to receive what they said a white education. They were taken to these schools, their hair was cut, they were forced to wear Western clothes, they were even forced to abandon their names, they had to pick Western names. And they were beaten and abused if they spoke their own language. In the Carlisle Indian School, they said over 10,000 Native kids have been through this school from 140 different tribes. On record, there's only about 158 students that actually graduated. There's 200 kids buried on the grounds. This is in Pennsylvania. But if you actually go dig a little deeper, there's at least 500 kids died. These schools did nothing more than beat the culture out of us. The culture was beaten out of us because we were a problem, because we were looked at as less than. The last boarding school closed in about 2007. I bring all of these up because history like this, a bunch of natives took over Alcatraz in 1969. You guys ever heard of that before? A bunch of Indians took over Alcatraz and occupied it for almost 2 years. But this is not part of the discourse of the civil rights movement, even though it's smack dab in the middle of it. A group of Indians started from one end of the country and drove to the other end of the country, and they had a sit-in in what they called the Trail of Broken Treaties. They took over and had a sit-in in a government building in the Department of the Interior in 1972. That's crazy. Like, that is amazing. There are pictures of Indians on the roofs. I tried to find some. I couldn't find any, but they're on the roofs of these government buildings. And the reason why I bring these up is because most people don't know this. Most people don't consider it as part of the timeline of civil rights. And when we don't learn about the things that happen and why they happen, we're automatically giving those things power and a hierarchy over other things. If we know that Abraham Lincoln is the great emancipator, but we don't know that he signed off on the largest mass hanging of Native people in this country, then what does that say about our existence as indigenous people? So it all comes down to ownership. You know, the Declaration of Independence, you know, very, very nicely says that we are told these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In that same document, it refers to us as merciless Indian savages. These documents that are important to the existence of this country and the governments that we have set up are not based on a sense of equality. They are just not. And those things have to be reconciled for all people of color. Because when you look at Indians, you know what's funny about this? The original Tonto, this is him. His name is Jay Silverheels. He was a Mohawk man. The original Tonto was played by a real Indian. And in 2018, we land on Johnny Depp. But these things exist in the public sphere with statements like, we're honoring you. There is no frame of reference to the importance of what a headdress is. A headdress is only known to be the quintessential piece of what an American Indian is. And that's, you know, you look at the last American Indian on Earth, that was a centerpiece to that entire outfit because I know how people react to that. There are 567 different tribes in the United States that are recognized by the federal government. And of those, there's another 200 or 300 that are not federally recognized, that are often state recognized. And there are 300 different languages. There are different dialects within those languages. And out of all of those, there's maybe about a dozen tribes that actually wear headdresses traditionally. And yet, that is quintessentially what we are. But there's not much difference from, you know, the chill white dude at Coachella and fans of teams and how incredibly audacious those fans are. This is about erasure. This is about an image of a group of people that doesn't actually represent that group of people. And by having these images exist in popular culture, they take away our very existence, the diversity of that existence, and the ability for us to even proclaim that this is not correct and that this is not right, that this is not who we are. Because ultimately, we don't own our image. Now think about that for a second. As we try to self-identify, as we connect with our homelands, our languages, our traditions, and our ceremonies, we are not being given quarter in this country to identify ourselves. And while many would take something like mascots and say, well, it's not that big of a deal, you take a fan from an opposing team who thinks it's a good idea to put that head on the end of a spike. Now, the historical context of an image like this is incredible. But these things are in plain sight. But they are completely open and completely ignored by the vast majority of the United States because we, even though I'm standing right in front of you, don't exist. There is such a thing as a good Indian and a bad Indian. The good Indian talks about Mother Earth and talks about Father Sky, gives you an Indian name, maybe talks about those exciting spirit animals. And the bad Indian looks like this. The bad Indian can articulate exactly what is wrong enough to be able to make you feel uncomfortable. This is a Lakota gentleman who was arrested for performing a sweat ceremony. I want you guys to consider this, because in this country, the land of the home, land of the free, the home of the brave, where we have freedom of speech and freedom of religion, that indigenous religion was illegal until 1978. That's within my lifetime. When there was a congressional act, the American Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1978. Think about that for a second. Think about that when the Boy Scouts are dressing up like Indians and doing an Arrow of Light ceremony, and that we have Native kids that can't even speak their language. They're being forced to not speak their language. You cannot dress in that way. You cannot perform that ceremony. And this is significant. And this brings us to a modern place, a modern era. We are more likely to be killed by law enforcement than any other ethnic group in the country, followed very closely, obviously, by the Black community. This is from the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice. And last June, this gentleman, his name's Zachary Bareheels, he's 29, he was on his way home to Oklahoma, and he has some mental disorders. He's bipolar, he's schizophrenic, and he was on a bus, and he got off the bus, and he was very agitated, and his mom called the police of this town that he was in Nebraska. And he said, my son just got off this bus, and I need him to get on the bus because I need to get him home. And so the police went and they found him, and they put him on the phone with his mom. And his mom could tell that he was off his medications. His mom was very upset and was just wanted him home as quickly as possible. The police put handcuffs on him, and they put him in the back of the cruiser to take him back to the bus station to put him on the bus. He managed to get away. He slipped away. They chased him down, and they tackled him, and they tased him, and they tased him to death. And after they tased him, they picked him up, and they drug his body by his ponytails and by his legs. This happened last June. And this is an epidemic that is happening in Indian country, where we have to live in fear in different communities. You know, it might not happen here, but in places where there's a lot more Native people, happens all the time. It happens all the time. And even more than that, we're in this other place where our women, our indigenous women, face more violence, sexual violence, than any other person in this country. 2.5 times more likely to be raped or sexually assaulted. And though rape is always an act of violence, there's evidence that indigenous women are more likely to suffer additional violence at the hands of their perpetrators. According to the Department of Justice, in at least 86% of the reported cases of rape and sexual assault against indigenous women, survivors reported that the perpetrators are non-native men. This is an epidemic, and the epidemic goes even further than that. We have missing and murdered indigenous women and children. These statistics that exist for missing people are kept track of in this country for every single demographic except indigenous people. Let's talk about erasure when it comes to the fact that we have an epidemic of missing people and we can't even be considered when the statistics come down the pike, because we're 1% of the population, 2% of the population. There's 5 million of us, but that's not enough to matter. The minority of the minority. The first racial slur I ever heard was when I was in kindergarten, and they called me a prairie nigger. Imagine how shocking it is when you're 5 or 6 and you realize that the land of your birth, the land of your forefathers, the land of your inheritance has no place for you. That those that hold up and sustain this as the greatest country has made significant efforts to eradicate you and your family and your ancestors. And when they failed, they put that same effort into forgetting you. And this is where we are. Where not only is there not a place for me, but the majority of this country actually believes that I'm dead. even when we do proclaim our place, demanding that this nation and its citizens recognize that we're still here, and our culture and our language and our traditions are still here. We are faced with hostility. There are hostiles in our homelands. And even now, we are faced with visitors, immigrants, people who are derived from immigrants, that tell us that we're un-American if we don't pledge allegiance to the flag that has never symbolized us. The flag that symbolizes freedom and opportunity, where traditionally there's been a concerted effort to keep us, indigenous people, from those things. That when I hear the Star Spangled Banner, I have to be concerned about whether or not I should put my hand over my heart and I should sing along, when I know that that song is not for me. I know that that song was never for me. It never felt like it was for me. And the American dream was built really for only one people under one idea and one concept. And it requires me to relinquish my identity and my culture, my language and my people. And I simply cannot do that.
You're listening to Greg Deal, The Indigenous Identity and Existence, Fighting Erasure and Racism is the name of his presentation. It was delivered at Colorado College in Colorado Springs, Colorado on March 26, 2018. I invite you to join us for the second half in a few moments. This is First Voices Radio. My name is Teokasin Ghost Horse.
South Africa some years back, and there was a man, there was this white man, he was so upset because of the changes that were coming to his country. He was upset because the ones who were earlier under him were now supposed to be his equals. I felt sorry for the man, so I wrote him a song. I thought it must be hard when you, your whole life, you heard, you learned, you believed that some people are over other people. Some people have more value than other people. And then the world changes, and you have to realize we are all the same. It must be hard.
I want you to consider this, and this is true too for the black community, that there are over 500 years of bones buried in this land. Corpses that are a stark reminder of what colonialism is and what colonialism continues to be. And that even today, burial grounds of my ancestors are being buried up with steel and metal to make way for industry, disregarding our entire existence and the stake that we have in it. How can we possibly be concerned with upholding the very thing that has torn our families apart and told us that we are savages and that we are civilized? Because if this is civilization, I don't want any part of it. There is no moral code, and unfortunately the moral code needs to be upheld by our citizens. The moral code needs to be upheld by us. If the powers that be tell you over and over again that I am worth less than you, then where does that put your morals? What kind of value is given to my life or my child's life or the life of those who've already passed? When your history lessons tell of the fortitude and grit of your pioneer ancestors, remember that they had to kill other human beings and they had to step over those corpses to get to where they got. This isn't heroics to me, but this is a product of murder and greed. And I recognize that there's different ways of looking at things. But if you visit someone's home and you track mud on their newly clean carpet, your intent means very little because they can see exactly what you did. To not apologize for tracking mud in someone's house would be considered rude, and chances are you wouldn't be invited back. At the very least, they might talk trash about you and your reputation might go down the drain. And here's the thing. Perspective means very little when the end result has a universally bad outcome. And if death is the product of your effort, you might be the bad guy. And if you benefit from that outcome while not being a perpetrator, you are complicit in the actions and the loss of life of torture, dismemberment, rape, and murder. These things must be reconciled. That's it. These things must be reconciled. Everywhere that you walk on this land is Indian land. There were people that were here first. There are streets that are named after our tribes and using our words. And these are the things that must be acknowledged and that must be recognized. We also have to accept something, and this is in my mind, the most important point for the closing. The narrative that's been given to us has been designed to reassure us that there has been no crimes committed. We view the efforts of the pioneer and the colonialist with reverence, and the expansion of the West as an effort fueled by divinity and progress. We have romanticized one of the greatest massacres in world history, and to the entire Western world, it doesn't matter. I've been told that there are more important things to worry about. But you know, I'm a father, and as a father, I can't think of anything that is more important than the health and well-being of my children. But even when I look out here to all you guys, to young people, you are the future. You are the very thing that can enact change. That letters like what happened last week, they serve as a stark reminder of the work that needs to be done. They serve as a tool, as bad as it is, it serves as a tool to help us know exactly where things are at and exactly what needs to change. Reconciliation is not going to be easy for anybody. Having difficult conversations that make you uncomfortable and that make you squirm a little bit is part of the process of healing and finding equality. I am all about everybody being human and everybody being part of the human experience and all of us existing in the same place. But the way in which I speak is speaking in language that is understood, that there is a separation of races, that there's been a constant consideration in the separation of races, and not just races, but also gender, and also identity within that gender, that those things do not have a sense of equality. And that is what our country is built upon. But if we take the time to exercise our rights to speak out, to resist, to learn, to consider history, to consider our place, to consider the places of your neighbor, then we can find reconciliation and we can move forward. It's going to take a while. But I'm looking at you guys, I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic that the change can happen and it can happen through you because you are our future, as much to me as my own children are my future. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. So very much. There's just about 5 minutes for question and answer period.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you. When I read the email that was sent out last week, the part of it that surprised me, I guess not surprised, but struck me the most was the word that was used, moon cricket. And you laugh, I laughed a little bit because I thought it was quite
ridiculous. I laughed
because
I thought it was satire when I read it. I was like, what is this? But it's not funny, but yes, it's a ridiculous statement. Please.
So I didn't know what it was, and I had to look it up. Mm-hmm. I looked it up, and it said it was similar to words like porch monkey, mm-hmm. coon. And when I read the definition on Urban Dictionary, actually, it said a group of excuse my worst of the N word, but a group of niggas who stay up late at night making noise. And with the reclaiming of the N-word, I just want to hear your opinion about a word like that that is so deep. It comes from so far back in time. It's such an ancient slur.
Yeah.
But it still is applicable.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard black people use this word or try to reclaim this word, but I wanted to know if you think that's possible and right? If you think that's the black community taking ownership, or if you think that that is something that could be detrimental to people of color. But for me, when I heard the word, I had a feeling, and the feeling was like a strange and familiar sense of connection with the word.
Yeah.
Although it is a slur.
Yeah. So language is an interesting thing, and I would never assume to speak for the black community, because the black community has a very unique situation with the N-word, that there's a reclamation of that word. And it's understood that if anybody uses that word, that you're a certain type of person, and that it has a different set of rules that exist within the black community that has a varying degree of opinions and thoughts of whether or not that's appropriate. That's an incredible amount of power. And now I don't know about the term moon cricket as far as like a reclamation, but there has already been a reclamation of a word. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I think that's incredible is because indigenous people are not given an opportunity to reclaim words. That's why there's a football team called Redskins. And even in the argument, and so this is the contention of words too, in that argument, there's a football team in, I think, Arizona. They also, their mascot is the Redskins, and the school is predominantly indigenous kids. And so, obviously, their experience with that word would be completely different because they're all sort of informing each other on that word. But fans would say, well, they get to use the word, so how come I don't get to use the word? Which is also an argument that's been used in the past for something like the N-word. But that's about consideration and like a lack of consideration and ownership. Well, you know, you get to use it because it's in our language and it's our word. So why can't we use that word? And so the reclamation of words, I believe, has to have a consideration of the fact that nobody else gets to use those words but us. I think that, yeah, you can or should reclaim those words, but it's so incredibly difficult because we are up against white folks that believe that they have as much access to those words as we do, if not even a greater stake in it, which is really strange. It's really strange, but it's difficult to navigate. Honestly, it's a lot of thinking. I mean, like, there's a piece that says American genocide reconciled through football. That entire thing was about fans that believe that they are honoring me or honoring the legacy of my people through grown men in tights tackling each other. And I, in five words, figured out how to say that. It took a long time to figure that out because that's part of this effort of trying to navigate in a way that we can think critically on how do we talk about these things? How do we help people know about those things? And unfortunately for people of color, our work is cut out for us. There's a lot that has to be looked at and thought about, and that's why I'm so about history, because those things add the context to that. I mean, full disclosure, I read that letter and I called three people before I found somebody who'd even heard of that word before. And she's like super, super well read, and she immediately was like, unfortunately, I've heard of that. I've never heard that before. And so I think that does come down to historical context. But we have to figure out how to speak. How do we speak in a language that they understand? And that's the great trial. That's the great difficulty. I don't consider myself to be an Indian. I'm a Paiute. We call ourselves Numa, which means the people. I would specifically call myself Kuyui Takata, which means that we're the eater of a specific kind of fish. But nobody understands that. I have to speak in a language that people understand. And that's part of the process. As hard and difficult as that is, and as anti-decolonization as that is, I have to speak in a language that everybody can understand. Does that help?
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Indigenous Identity and Existence, Fighting Erasure and Racism. It was delivered at Colorado College in Colorado Springs, Colorado on March 26, 2018. Greg Deal is a husband and father, an artist, and a member of the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe. This is First Voices Radio. My name is Teokasin Ghost Horse. Thank you.
it's a long road. Oh. Every day I wake up and turn my phone on. I read the news of the day just as it's coming down. I do my best not to let it get me down. I try to keep my head up, but this is Babylon. This world's in crisis, we try to fight it. This changing climate, with scientists and with politicians divided by it. So many ways we could solve it, but they will never sign it. This mountain's tumbling down, but still we try to climb it. It's in the Torah, Quran, and in the Bible. Love is the message, but somehow we turn to rivals. It's come to people always picking up their rifles. Another school getting shot up, homicidal. Some people trying to look fly, some people trying to get high. Some people losing their mind, some people trying to get by. And when you look in my eyes, you'll see the sign of the times. We are looking for the same thing. But what if this song was number one? Would it mean that love had won? Would it mean that the world was saved? And no guns are being drawn today. What if everybody had a job and nobody had to break a law? What if everyone could say, yeah, yeah, that it's good to be alive today? Safer when they would hear a siren. Like help is on its way, but now they only think of violence. Another youth in the streets and police is in a conflict. And now they hear the guns click. Yo, Ebola crisis and ISIS is taking heads off. A drone is bombing the village and now the kids all signing up to be soldiers, but they are willing now to do the killing now. But are you willing now? Some politicians out there making us some problems and trying to tell the people that they can solve them with TV shows and sound bites and quotes. But everybody knows that it's all about the cash flow. They're telling you and me they're making progress, but tell it to the millions of jobless. It's like a players club with billions of dollars. To get the votes, you got to make it rain in Congress. Some people trying to look fly, some people trying to get high, some people losing their mind, some people trying to get by. And when you look in my eyes, you can see the sign of the times. We are looking for the same thing. But what if this song was number one? Would it mean that love had won?
The KBOO Development Committee meets the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m. and is looking for new members. Work on the committee includes evaluating and implementing fundraising and outreach strategies, developing and strengthening partnerships and collaborations, and advocating for KBOO in the community. If you are interested in joining the committee, contact Development Director Allison Kolb at allison@kboo.org to learn more. Meetings are held at KBOO, located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Please call the station at 503-231-8032 prior to the meeting to confirm that it is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Pete Sigard Tribute and 100th Birthday Celebration on Friday, May 3rd from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. The 6th annual Pete Sigard Tribute is a family-friendly sing-along event that features Lauren Sheehan, Peter Hayes, Ben Davis, Bill Merlin, and many more. Again, that's the Portland Pete Sigard Tribute and 100th Birthday Celebration on Friday, May 3rd from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Thank you.
wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole.